Welcome to Hallel Fellowship, found on the internet at hallel.info. That's hallel.info. We hope you are encouraged by the following recorded Bible study to look deeper into every word that proceeds from the mouth of God and how they were lived out in the life of Yeshua HaMashiach, often called Jesus the Christ.
We are in Exodus, Yitro. We're Exodus chapter 18 through chapter 20. Jethro, the minister of Midian, the father-in-law of Moses, heard everything that God did to Moses and to Israel, his people. The Lord had taken Israel out of Egypt. Jethro, the father-in-law of Moses, took Zipporah, the wife of Moses, after she had been sent away, and her two sons, of whom the name of one was Gershom, for he had said, I was a sojourner in a strange land. And the name of the other was Eleazar. For the God of my father came to my aid. He saved me from the sword of Pharaoh. Jethro, the father-in-law of Moses, came to Moses with his sons and his wife to the wilderness where he was encamped by the mountain of God. He said to Moses, I, your father-in-law Jethro, have come to you with your wife and her two sons with her. Moses went out to meet his father-in-law, and he prostrated himself and kissed him, and each inquired about the other's well-being. Then they came to the tent. Moses told his father-in-law everything that the Lord had done to Pharaoh in Egypt for Israel's sake, all the travail that had befallen them on the way, and the Lord had rescued them. Jethro rejoiced over all the good the Lord had done for Israel, that he had rescued it from the hand of Egypt. Jethro said, Blessed is the Lord who has rescued you from the hand of Egypt, and from the hand of Pharaoh, who has rescued the people from under the hand of Egypt. Now I know the Lord is far greater than all the gods, for in the very manner in which the Egyptians had conspired against them. Jethro, the father-in-law of Moses, took a burnt offering and feast offerings for God, and Aaron and all the elders of Israel came to eat bread with the father-in-law of Moses before God. It was on the next day that Moses sat to judge the people. The people stood by Moses from morning until evening. The father-in-law of Moses saw everything that he was doing to the people, and he said, What is this thing that you do to the people? Why do you sit alone with all the people standing by you from morning until evening? Moses said to his father-in-law, Because the people come to me to seek God. When they have a matter, one comes to me, and I judge between a man and his fellow, and I make known the decrees of God and his teachings. The father-in-law of Moses said to him, The thing that you do is not good. You will surely become worn out, you as well as this people that is with you. For this matter is too hard for you. You will not be able to do it alone. Now heed my voice. I shall advise you, and may God be with you. You be a representative to God, and you convey the matters to God. You shall caution them regarding the decrees and the teachings, and you shall make known to them the path which they should go, and the deeds that they should do. And you shall discern from among the entire people men of accomplishment, God-fearing people, men of truth, people who despise money. And you shall appoint them leaders of thousands, leaders of hundreds, leaders of fifties, and leaders of tens. They shall judge the people at all times. They shall bring every major matter to you, and every minor matter they shall judge. And it will be eased for you, and they shall bear with you. If you do this thing, and God shall command you, then you will be able to endure, and this people as well shall arrive at the destination in peace. Moses heeded the voice of his father-in-law and did everything that he had said. Moses chose men of accomplishment from among all Israel and appointed them heads of the peoples, leaders of thousands, leaders of hundreds, leaders of fifties, leaders of tents. They judge the people at all times. The difficult thing they would bring to Moses, and the minor thing they themselves would judge. Moses sent off his father-in-law, and he went to his land. Chapter 19. In the third month from the exodus of the children of Israel from Egypt, on this day they arrived at the wilderness of Sinai. They journeyed from Rephidim and arrived at the wilderness of Sinai and encamped in the wilderness, and Israel encamped there opposite the mountain. Moses ascended to God, and the Lord called to him from the mountain, saying, "So shall you say to the house of Jacob and relate to the children of Israel. You have seen what I did to Egypt, and that I have borne you on the wings of eagles and brought you to me. And now if you hearken well to me and observe my covenant, you shall be to me the most beloved treasure of all peoples, for mine is the entire world. You shall be to me a kingdom of ministers and a holy nation. These are the words that you shall speak, the children of Israel." Moses came and summoned the elders of the people and put before them all these words the Lord had spoken and commanded him. The entire people responded together and said, "Everything the Lord has spoken, we shall do." Moses brought back the words of the people to the Lord. The Lord said to Moses, "Behold, I come to you in the thickness of the cloud. The people will hear as I speak to you. They will also believe in you forever." Moses related the words of the people to the Lord. The Lord said to Moses, "Go to the people and sanctify them today and tomorrow. They shall wash their clothing. Let them be prepared for the third day. For on the third day, the Lord shall descend in the sight of the entire people on Mount Sinai. You shall set boundaries to people around about, saying, 'Beware of ascending the mountain or touching its edge. Whoever touches the mountain surely shall die. A hand shall not touch it, for he shall surely be stoned or thrown down, whether animal or human. He shall not live. Upon an extended blast of shofar, they may then ascend the mountain.'" Moses descended from the mountain to the people. He sanctified the people, and they washed their clothing. He said to the people, "Prepare after a three-day period. Do not draw near a woman." On the third day, when it was morning, there was great thunder and lightning, and a heavy cloud on the mountain, and the sound of the shofar was very powerful. The entire people that was in the camp shuddered. Moses brought the people forth from the camp toward God. They stood at the bottom of the mountain. All Mount Sinai was smoking because the Lord had descended upon it in fire. Its smoke ascended like the smoke of the furnace, and the entire mountain shuddered exceedingly. The sound of the shofar grew continually much stronger. Moses would speak, and God would respond to him with a voice. The Lord descended upon the Mount Sinai to the top of the mountain. The Lord summoned Moses to the top of the mountain, and Moses ascended. The Lord said to Moses, "Descend, warn the people, they say, break through to the Lord to see, and a multitude of them will fall. Even the Kohanim who approach the Lord should be prepared, lest the Lord burst forth against them." Moses said to the Lord, "The people cannot ascend the Mount Sinai, for you have warned us, saying, 'Bound the mountain and sanctify it.'" The Lord said to him, "Go, descend. Then you shall ascend, and Aaron with you. But the Kohanim and the people, they shall not break through to ascend the Lord, lest he burst forth against them." Moses descended to the people and said to them, "God spoke these statements, saying, 'I am the Lord your God, who has taken you out from the land of Egypt, the house of slavery. You shall not recognize the gods of others in my presence. You shall not make yourself a carved image or any likeness of that which is in the heavens above, or on the earth below, or in the water beneath the earth. You shall not prostrate yourself to them, nor worship them, for I, the Lord your God, am a jealous God, who visits the sins of the fathers upon the children, the third and fourth generations, for my enemies, but who shows kindness for thousands to those who love me and observe my commandments. You shall not take the name of the Lord your God in vain. The Lord will not absolve anyone who takes his name in vain. Remember the Sabbath day to sanctify it. 6 days shall you work and accomplish all your work. But the seventh day is Shabbat to the Lord your God. You shall not do any work. You, your son, your daughter, your slave, your maidservant, your animal, your convert within your gates. For in 6 days the Lord made the heavens and the earth, the seas and all that is in them, and he rested on the seventh day. Therefore the Lord blessed the seventh day, Shabbat, and sanctified it. Honor your father and your mother, so that your days will be lengthened upon the land the Lord your God is giving you. You shall not kill. You shall not commit adultery. You shall not steal. You shall not bear false witness against your fellow. You shall not covet your fellow's house. You shall not covet your fellow's wife, his manservant, his maidservant, his ox, his donkey, nor anything that belongs to your fellow. The entire people saw the thunder and the flames, the sound of the shofar, the smoky mountain. People saw and trembled and stood from afar. They said to Moses, "You speak to us, and we shall hear. Let God not speak to us, lest we die." Moses said to the people, "Do not fear, for in order to elevate you has God come, so that awe of him shall be upon your faces, so that you shall not sin." The people stood from afar, and Moses approached to the thick cloud where God was. The Lord said to Moses, "So shall you say, the children of Israel, you have seen that I have spoken to you from the heaven. You shall not make images of what is with me, gods of silver or gold. You shall not make for yourselves. An altar of earth shall you make for me. You shall slaughter near it your burnt offerings, your peace offerings, your flock, your herd. Wherever I permit my name to be mentioned, I shall come to you and bless you. And when you make for me an altar of stones, do not build them of hewn stone, for you will have raised your sword over it and desecrated it. You shall not ascend my altar on steps, so that your nakedness will not be uncovered upon it." That was Exodus chapter 18, 19, and 20. Yeah, actually, it's relatively short. Only 3 chapters. There's some Torah portions are 6 chapters long. It's a relatively short one. Yeah, early ones. They want you to skim to the early ones fast. Quick read. Okay, go home. There's a lot. This has the Ten Commandments. There's a lot of stuff in the Ten Commandments, which we'll talk about today. Any comments, questions, opinions, things I can answer for you quickly before I go on my own spiel? Yes, Daniel.
Beginning, it sounds like Moses and his wife, like Moses sent his wife away with a divorce.
Well, it's interesting. In order to give a divorce, he has to give her a piece of paper that says so. Else it's not a divorce. Well, meaning in the Torah explains why that's a requirement. Now, granted, I realize that law wasn't given yet, per se, but the principle behind of how you send a wife off for divorce, it would still have to be done in some fashion, some method. In this instance, you could argue that, I do not know, most people interpret this very differently as far as what that meant, as far as why his wife and children were sent off. And the reason they interpret it differently is because, well, if Moses was going into Egypt, which he did, and it appears his wife and his children went with him because the angel was there, but then you have the 10 plagues that were going to happen. And as long as Moses is in Egypt, he is susceptible to Pharaoh arresting his family. And so it would be in his best interest to say, "Wife, children, you don't want to be here, because then Pharaoh has something over me, send you out." That's the most common interpretation of He sent them back to her to be with her dad. That's the interpretation. I mean, it's right. It's interpretation. Yes.
He was a workaholic.
Yeah. A workaholic.
He had no time for his wife.
Right. Wife and kids. I'm busy. Yes, Deborah.
Okay, so a couple questions. Eyes on. Okay, so Moses ascended and then descended from the mountain.
Right. Yep.
And the people could not ascend up to the mountain yet. And then and God was in the thickness of the cloud. He talked about that. And then how and when, and someone's using God's name in vain, how would you know? Like people say GD, you know?
Oh.
So I wonder if you're going to talk about that.
Hold on, I'm writing these questions down so I don't forget them. Okay. So you go the up and down the mountain.
Yeah, people going ascend and descend because he emphasized ascend and descend.
Mm-hmm.
And then he said another thing he also said in there, and to despise money, thickness of the cloud.
And what was your fourth one?
And then the down the road was the people then couldn't ascend.
Right.
And then his name in vain.
Oh, the vain, that was it.
Yeah, the vain. And then also was is that the law hadn't been given, but the law, there was law that was given because remember when Abraham followed him, was it Abraham?
Yes.
When he followed him, he knew that he would, you know, everybody all over knew the law of the land because Jethro came and Moses took his advice. So he must have been somebody quite extraordinary, you know, as somebody that he would follow and even give that advice to begin with such a large crowd of people. And I still think that works for today. When you find somebody with wisdom in a group, you know, and somebody, you know, I mean, some people have the wrong wisdom to give a large group, as you see in church places. But I mean, if we go according to the Torah, we don't have to worry about what we're saying.
Right. You know, you can cross check it.
According to this
word.
Yeah,
you cross check it. If you say something against this, then what you're saying is incorrect. And
right. And also, I really think it's important to do an intake. Like, I wouldn't give the same advice to two different people when they have, maybe she's married, she's single, or, you know, so Jethro, you know.
The wisdom of Jethro.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, where did he get it from?
Yeah. Where did he get it? It was a Midianite priest. Mm-hmm. And I left my other paper at home that I had all these questions. They were so good.
Okay.
And then on Chabad, it was the seeing and hearing is what changed the people's behavior. You know, a lot of the people, and there was a mixed multitude, which were obviously Egyptians, but they were seeing and hearing. So it was brought out in the teaching about to know God is to see and hear.
Yeah, it's a combination. You
can't,
yeah, one
I thought,
does not
wow,
work.
Wow, you know, because right. Today we are following God. What we don't, maybe some do, but necessarily hear. There's a lot of teaching out there that causes us not to, we go to their teaching, huh?
Sensationalism.
Yeah, there's sensationalism in. Yeah. And then, you know, people get confused. You know, I hear, like, all this week, I've talked to three different people, and she's doing three feasts because of the confusion, because she's so afraid to miss. I said, well, look at the moon. But so, I mean, these three are so, so, so important. So I'm just excited to hear the teaching.
Yeah, we talk about most of these. I did not write down, to be honest, anything regarding the whole going up and down of the mountain, the up and down process. But we'll talk about a little bit. Maybe we'll talk a little bit shortly about that. Most of these we will address, though, during my little spiel. Any other comments or questions that I won't be talking about? Yes.
What third day are they talking about?
Oh, that's a good question.
That's what I want to know. Yep. Is what is that third day?
Yep, we'll discuss that as well a little bit. That is on... Where do my notes go? Yes, it is. It's please come here. Third day. Yes, the washing and cleaning. Yep. Yeah, third day from whatever day dots I'm doing. Okay. Oh, yes, Larry.
We keep hearing this thing of this is holy place. Mm-hmm. Stay off of it. Don't touch it.
Right.
Unless you die.
Right.
And I know it's set aside for a special purpose.
Right.
But it just seems like we don't have anything in our society, even in our messianic society, that we can't touch or we can't do or we can't get nearer because why?
Why? Are you asking why does he have one or why we don't have one?
Yeah.
Wait a minute. That's two different questions.
Why did he do that?
Does he have one?
And why does he not seem to really care
do one
about
anymore?
That now, yeah.
Okay, that's okay. there's a couple of reasons for that, and I don't know all of them, but that I'm familiar with. Hopefully, we'll talk a little bit about that as we get to that particular aspect of it. That is a lengthy topic, so I don't know if I'll get to all of it today. Distinguishing what is holy, what's not holy, meaning what's set aside, what has a purpose, what does not have a purpose. Holiness and purpose change over time. I have a use for my car, for example. My car, I won't have use for it right now because I'm standing. I don't need it right now, so it has a function at a time. So everything God built has a use for a time. So the holy mountain is on, which we assume, it's an assumption, it's the same one where the burning bush was, because God said, on this mountain, I don't know where the bush was on it, but somewhere on there, there's a bush, that this is all holy and set aside. Note, humans nor animals were allowed on the mountain. So you couldn't say, oh, well, an animal wandered on, I can't go get it. I have to kill it from a distance, or God has to kill it to get rid of whatever is on the mountain. Nothing alive beyond it. There's a situation which God has, and he's teaching a very, very important principle here, that God cannot dwell as a normal dwelling would be with flesh. That's the principle which he's instructing. But then we have this example that Moses and Aaron have some unique properties amongst them that allow God to dwell with them. So he's showing the people the example of there is what is flesh and human being and uncleanliness, which is incompatible with God's presence. And then there's individuals who can. Why? What is so different about Moses and Aaron versus everybody else? That's what the connection is. Identify why are those two men so special? What's unique about them? What makes them odd? Like they can ascend up and not die, and the rest of us can't. That's what the connection is. Hence why it ties into the Deborah's question about ascending and descending. What does that mean to ascend and descend? And who is allowed to and why? What does it matter? Again, who is permitted to identifies as the key as to who gets to ascend, who doesn't get to ascend, is why there are differences in how God set this up. We'll discuss this in more detail when Aaron is selected as the high priest and what he can and cannot do and how he's done it. Nobody else is allowed to do certain things. It's the exact same principle, same picture. So we have these individuals that are selected to do certain tasks. They can do things that no one else can do. It is a form which is... I forgot the Hebrew word, forgive me, maybe you might remember. It's a form of agency. It's a modern day word for agency. We use the term, the prophets, for example, all the prophets were agents of God.
Human service.
What was that? No, that's not the right word. That's a different word for it. Agency is representative. So, for example, if I send, let's say I'm the president, I'm not, the president of something important, and I send an agent to go take care of some business from a far distance. Whoever my agent is, they are speaking on... Shalim, thank you. That's the word. They're speaking on my behalf. Whatever they say, they're acting as if I'm the one speaking. So all the examples of the prophets say, God said blah, 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 whatever it is. They're acting as God's agent. Now, God's not himself not physically there. The person his representative is. Now, if the people then slaughter the prophet, they're mad at him, they kill him for it, they're killing God. They're killing God. That's the example given. As Messiah's point, Jerusalem, long mourn for you that you've slain the prophets. They're slaying God's agents. It's a principle of agency. No, that is throughout our Tanakh, our entire Torah, as well as the New Testament points at the exact same thing. An agent is someone who's represented somebody else. The other person cannot arrive for whatever reason, but the agent does. So we have the high priest, which is our agent. We have Moses, which is an agent. They're representing God. So that's why God talked to Moses, the burning bush said, I will make you like God to Pharaoh. Well, how is that possible? He's a flesh and blood person. You can kick him and he says, ow, I have a bruise. It can't be God. But he's acting as God in Pharaoh's, in front of Pharaoh, as if he is God. So he's God's agent. He is not really God, but he's acting like it. So when Moses does this, or Moses does that, or Aaron does this, Aaron does that, it, even though God's the one who's the power behind it, those two men are the picture, the face of what God looked, the image of him. And not like what they look like necessarily, but his representative on it. That's an agency. So when we deal with agency, that's what we deal with Moses and Aaron versus other people. So Moses and Aaron are allowed to go up to God. People cannot go up the mountain. They are not God's agents. So the people must be represented by Moses and Aaron and to Moses and Aaron instead of God directly. It's an agency process. Messiah did the same thing. The one sent is not greater than the one who sent him. So the Son is not greater than the Father who sent him. He is representing the Father. Now he's acting on his behalf. He has Father's power behind him. He is God's agent. He's represented what he's doing, and he shows through forgiveness of sin, he even has God's power behind him to do so. Which an agent would then do that. They can do that. An agent has, I'm speaking for whoever I'm representing. I'm saying the person I'm representing is going to do X, Y, Z, whatever it is. And here I'm demonstrating it, and here it's done. The agent has the power to do that. Hence, the prophets could do various miracles at different times. Elijah, for example, could do a lot of different things. So, of course, could Elisha, as well as a few other prophets, as well as even Moses and Aaron, did various miracles in their time. They're representing God as an agency. So they're the shlokim, the representative, the person who's in front, the image of God, so to speak. Does that make sense? So that's how we separate these men out. So God was saying, all right, I have selected Moses and Aaron as my agents, the people who will communicate with you. Everybody else, you aren't chosen. You must stay aside, outside the realm of this mountain that I'm sitting on. You don't belong. You are not the agent that I'm choosing to go through. For example, how many of us are the same as Messiah? All of us and none of us. We're all sons of God, yet we're not all sons of men. Which is funny. We're all sons of God, but we're not all son of man. We're not all the son of man. Which is funny. We're not all Adam, but we're all descendants thereof. So we all belong to God and his people, but we are not the Messiah himself. He is the one chosen, the God that will choose the one, not everybody else. And so we have one example. It's the agency of selection. God has chosen one individual. In Messiah's case, it's a combination of Moses and Aaron during the Exodus. There's a different reason why Aaron eventually will replace Moses. But that's how the process works. Does it make any questions? Does it make sense how agency is supposed to work?
I'm thinking about exactly that. Places we can't touch.
If you have places you can't touch, in the case of holiness, I won't go that yet, that's for later. The case of holiness, which means set aside. Kadosh is Hebrew word, kadosh. Or Kiddush, there are a lot of different ways which you can pronounce, depending on what type of pronunciation you're doing, depending on what you're talking about. Holy, set aside. Now, you can set aside a person, you can set aside a place. This is how we do with Moses and Aaron, where there are people being set aside for this agency process. And, of course, there's also place, in this case, the mountain of God is set aside. So the mountain of God was a set-aside place that's distinct or unique. So the place, in this case, we're discussing. The mountain, yes. The place that God designed that is set aside, a unique spot that God made, which is a place. Yes, he does a tabernacle this way. He does the Holy of Holies this way. He does his personal ark, his seat that no one's allowed to touch. You have to pose because it's set aside. It's a unique application. Set aside place or things. You can argue they're all kind of similar in what they do. They have a function. As long as the function's legitimate, the thing has to be set aside. Can the set aside thing be contaminated? Yes, it can. Is it then still set aside? No, it's not. I apologize. I'll write it bigger. It's also scribbly scratched, so I apologize. So set aside, in this case, with things or places. So things are a place, something that's set aside. We already discussed Moses and Aaron were people set aside. Those are humans. So as Messiah is a human, the prophets were humans set aside. He's asking us, but things in places that God set aside. Things in place have a temporary time. Humans do too. Moses and Aaron didn't live forever. But the place also has a different length of time and how long it's useful for. things and places can be contaminated. We have this example of which have the temple gets contaminated, which people walk into it. They shouldn't, but they do. Various times in the Maccabean period, which they do a lot of sacrifices in it that don't belong. A lot of things can be contaminated. And they had even the stones, the altar that were used in the Maccabean period, when they came back and said, these stones have had pig blood on them. They were once holy. What do we do with them? We don't know. So we set them aside. We take them out and set them aside. Somebody figure out what to do with these stones later because they were once holy. Can they be washed again? We don't know. Because if you wash, for example, if it was a piece of iron, you just get it fired up. And it's cleanable. It's now that can be purified. But can you do stone that way? Not pottery, but can you stone? That they're not sure. Can you just burn the stone up and now it's usable again, or is it not? And they're not positive. They set aside until somebody else figures out the solution. We don't know. These places, when it comes to things and places, God had pointed out that these things have their function for this period of time. But as we saw when we read throughout the entire Tanakh story, there are times those things he set aside get contaminated at one time or another. For now, you don't want touching it. Later, it doesn't matter, but for now, I don't want you touching it. The things and places, even Messiah pointed out when he was raised to the grave, don't touch me. I've not gone to my Father yet. Now, we debate what that means, but in the basic principle, if we just on its surface appearance only, it means don't physically touch him because he's been set aside. Don't touch the mountain. You don't belong to it. Same principle. Until God meets him, or however that's supposed to work, we don't know. And then that supposedly that is then clean. That's on only a face reading of that. I realize there's deep stuff there, which I'm not going to talk about today. So even a human being can be set aside for a temporary span in time, and then no longer set aside later. Does that make sense? So everything has a purpose for a period of time. When the period of time is over, the purpose is completed, the set-asideness goes away. Now, why don't we have this anymore today? That was an earlier question. How come we don't have things that are holy now? I mean, I set this book down, and oh no, I don't know what was here on this table before. Is the book clean or not clean? I don't know. Doesn't really matter. Why does it not matter? Because you said, okay, no. that's a great argument, but no. That's not the reason why it doesn't matter. Why does it not matter? Because what is set aside that can never get contaminated ever, 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 ever? Messiah can't get contaminated. All right. Now, what is in the book that can't get contaminated?
The Torah.
Yeah, the knowledge, the wisdom, what's in here. I can never set that aside. Can I ever contaminate it? Only by misreading it, misapplying it, incorrectly doing it, mistranslating it. I can mess it up on purpose, but I have to choose to do so. The knowledge in here is set aside forever. It never goes away because it's wisdom and knowledge. It's how you live. So we can see that the book itself is just a physical book. What's the knowledge in it that cannot be contaminated? It's always set aside. That's what we're actually after. That's what we discuss about this every day. Or every day, every week, however often it may be.
What about when the Jews,
The same principle. As long as your memory works. Yeah, I don't know. As long as your memory works, you can memorize what's written in it, which is acceptable too. But that's the nature of what makes it holy, is it's what's in it, not the thing itself. Don't add, don't subtract. If the information is in here, it's what we actually study, right? It's not the pages. We don't measure the dimensions. We don't critique the color of black they chose for the writing or how big the letters were. That doesn't matter. What the information is what we choose, what we study. That's what we set aside every Shabbat, and we study stuff in order to learn that the information's in it. So it's not a thing that you can touch. It's not a place. It's an idea that you can always say, this remains holy. Yes, Daniel.
So why would God tell them to wash their clothes, but not themselves? I mean, it's a picture of you're clean on the outside, but not on the inside.
That's a good question. This is a small amount of speculation that I'm going to answer with. Not a lot of anything else, just a little speculation, is that bathing at that time was not done every day. We bathe pretty much here almost every day. There's some people don't, but most people bathe every day. Bathing time was not done every day. It was done on occasion. Once a week, once a month, whatever it may be, who knows. Now, after the Torah was given, The tradition changed to all humans bathed Friday. And all Israelites bathed on Fridays. Every Friday, everybody bathed. That was it became the new tradition, the new standard. They didn't bathe every day of the week, but every Friday they bathed. They didn't know it happened to beforehand, but they did this time. The reason is they determined through what God said to the priests, you come before me, clean yourselves up. They said, oh, if we're going to go to the temple or go learn from God, we should clean ourselves up. Hence the tradition of cleaning yourselves every once a week. That became a tradition over time after reading the Torah and applying it to ordinary people, once a week bathing, which is more often than anybody else did it.
So the system of sacrifices hadn't been initiated yet.
Correct.
So
yet.
Their sins were not...
We're not God. No. All those who were not paid for yet. Now, we have, now you'll notice in this story, in chapter 20, sorry, chapter 19, when he's saying, don't come up the mountain, he lists the people don't come up, and the priests don't come up. Yeah. Wait a minute. Who are the priests? No one knew that yet. It says Moses can come up, and Aaron, of course, is invited up later in. But it doesn't tell us that the Levites are priests yet. They don't exist. The priesthood isn't determined. So why would God put that in there? Who's that? That's a good question. Who is that? You know an answer?
Yeah, well, they must have had priests in Egypt.
They did have priests in Egypt.
So they continued into the desert, too.
It's possible. We don't know. That's the nature. We ask this question, okay, why is this sentence in here? Because the Torah priests, those don't exist yet. They're a non-entity. You might as well be saying, don't let the zeros come up. What's a zero? I don't know. Any name I can lay up something that doesn't mean anything. Or it's possible that there were priests of other religions that were thought that they were holy too and could come up too, which is where Jethro comes in, which we're going to talk about Jethro. Oh, hold on, one at a time. Priests at this time, there weren't any, except, go ahead, what's your just an answer?
2 Peter 2:8-9. And also 1 Peter 2:9 talks about a kingdom of priests.
Oh yeah, but they don't exist yet. At this point, in which was discussing in chapter 19 of Exodus, God has not given that instruction yet. So no one knows what a priest is or isn't.
Well, if you read the word, he sent you
love for it. That's the point. For it will be, but it isn't at this time. We aren't past Exodus chapter 20 at this time in this story. So until we identify what a priest is, which it explains us later on in the book of Exodus, and Exodus chapter 19, 20, it doesn't define one yet, not until later on.
They are set aside people,
which is what God has set aside the humans. Now, God categorized Moses, separate from the people, separate from priests. He broke them into three different categories. He does not explain what a priest is, and Daniel has a speculation, which could be referring to the priests of other religions, which would make sense to Jethro showing up, because he's a priest of other religions. That could be. Or this chapter 19 and 20 was written down by Moses after the event actually happened, which is more likely what happened. Well, that's what we're going to talk about next, because chapter 18 is before chapter 20 in order of events. They're mixed up. Because things are not chronological in your Torah, they are subject matter based. They are not chronologically based. So that's when we get mixed up of words in the wrong place at the wrong time. Yes, Daniel.
So you think about their 400 years plus in slavery. It had to be their tradition that maintained their knowledge of God, of the patriarchs. So they must have had some kind of priest during that time that helped them to remember, helped them to repeat
teachers,
the oral
yeah.
teachers, oral yeah. traditions that kept that going. That would have been the law
the
that
elders.
They might have had from Noah
yeah.
and that. But I'm just suggesting that there were some...
There were, we call them the elders, the tribal leaders. That was their job, to make sure everybody was in line for their family. So I have a tribe, I've got 5 kids, but... And, 20 years from now or 30 years from now, if I'm still alive, God willing, I may have more, a bigger tribe, so to speak. It's my job to make sure my tribe is all in line doing what I can best explain to them. So in this case, when you go to the priests, the word can also be used as servant or someone who is distinguished or designated. So the same thing can be applied. So he could be arguing, pointing out, using the word in a more generic form as opposed to priest, but rather as someone who is in charge of their local tribes as a leader. Maybe, maybe not. Hard to say. We don't know for certain. But we're noting that because Jethro shows up in the scene in chapter 18, he makes references to stuff that hasn't happened until after chapter 19. We know the order is out of order. So we know the order is out of order, then there's a good chance Moses wrote this stuff down, not as it was happening, like chiseling out, oh, and then God did this. Oh, I misspelled that word. It wasn't like that. He was writing that after, hey, and then we were recalling what was going on. This is what God had requested or had specified, which makes more sense how the rest of the whole book is written. It's a memory almost, that half the wording is a past tense memory as opposed to an active current or future tense. So we can understand that there's probably written a little bit later than the actual event. It could be the next day, could be the next week. We don't know. Yes, Anne.
So the Hebrew word that's used, that's the word priest, can be also servant? Is that
it can be used in that form. It's not commonly used that form, but it can be used in that form. It's more commonly used form as a priest, as a, you think someone who's designated. Let's see here. It says in verse chapter 19, some people, type of spoke should do. All right, that's verse 21-22. So the Lord said to Moses, descend one of the people, lest they break through the Lord to see the multitude with them. Even the Kohanim, the priests, who approach the Lord should be prepared, lest the Lord burst forth against them. Yeah, Kohanim, which is... That was chapter 19, verse 21-22. See, even the Kohanim, who approach the Lord, should be prepared, lest the Lord burst forth against them. So he's identifying even the Kohanim, the priests, who approach the Lord. Now, at this time, those priests aren't defined in the Torah-wise, but they do exist, apparently, in this verse. That's where that was our discussion earlier. We're getting a little off track here, so I can get back on the track in a minute. Yes.
So, well, wouldn't they be like the leaders, like of the thousands, the hundreds of...
We have other words used for that that are not the priesthood. So it'd be different, it'd be odd choice of words. All right? Let me move forward, because there's more important things here than just detailing of this stuff. Yeah, this is very, very minor topics. Okay, there's more important things here. We're going to discuss about this real quick. Actually, not real quick. It's relatively slow. But chapter 18, let's jump back. Jethro. Jethro shows up. What does he hear about? Why does he show up? Bring mom and kids over. What did he hear about? How did he know Moses was there? Yeah. All the words had in Israel, in Egypt. The whole world heard about it. Everybody knew what happened in Egypt. The word spread quickly. This is only about a couple months later or so, and everybody knows what happened in Egypt. They all got the story. They all heard what the Egyptians said, of course. What was going on, the various observers. All the various plagues that happened, the Egypt being wiped out in the Red Sea. The whole world found out about this. And so Jethro shows up. Hey, I just found out about this. What happened? He wanted the detail, the inside scoop. Which, of course, what Moses then offers him after he checks on, obviously, his wife and his kids and such in that nature. They ask each other and do that kind of stuff. What I would point out to you is Jethro is a Midianite priest. Now, who is Midian? Who were they? Not yet. The enemy is in this, but not yet, not this time. It's a descendant. Not Lot's wife. There was the Moab and Ammon, where the Midian was an offspring of Abraham's, to some argue, third wife. It is a Keturah, I forgot her name. Ah, crud, I forgot it. Anyway, one of those descendants. So Midian, Jethro's family, they are a descendant of Abraham. All right, they came from Abraham. Now, coming from Abraham means what? What do they know that Abraham gave them? What heritage did they receive from Abraham? One God. And what was representative of one God? One circumcision. That was the only knowledge they've got for Abraham. They got some money, but that doesn't mean much. That's not worth much. But one God, one circumcision. That's the information that Abraham gave to them. That this is my inheritance to all of my children. He gave to all of his kids. Of course, Isaac's the one who ran with it, and everybody else kind of did their own thing. But any information that Abraham got, Abraham's story, how he got where he was, and the nature of God himself would also have been taught about it. So all these details, Midian knows. Recall your memory, when Moses went down into Egypt, there was an angel that had surrounded or tried to stop. We don't know whether it's Moses or his son. I'm not really sure that the pronouns aren't very accurate. And Zipporah circumcised Moses' son and said, "You're a husband of blood to me." Do you remember that? Remember that story? And she threw it at his feet. She was really mad and upset. She's from what tribe? Midian. Something changed. Because something had to have changed over the few hundred years up to when Midian was born and was circumcised, as all the males were, and they were all taught to do so. And continuing on the cycle, Ishmael was, even Esau's descendants were circumcised. They all had the same rules, the same God. But Jethro is a priest of Midian. And he even says in this chapter, when he meets Moses and talks to him, "Wow, your God is greater than all the gods," plural. Things have changed in Midian and Jethro. So Midian started out in I don't like to use this word, but I'm using it anyway, in a more purer or more cleaner form of worship when he was first born. Midian did, when he was first born, the boy, the man. But things have changed over time. Midian went from a single god to one circumcision to many gods and no circumcision. So he went from one and one to many and none. That's like the Midian descendants went. So Zipporah and, of course, obviously Jethro, they have many gods, they're polytheists, and no circumcision. Oh, sure. Yeah. I'll try to use a change marker color. I won't discuss your eyesight. Beyond the scope of our discussion. All right. So poly, I'll abbreviate because I'm a bad speller. Polytheists as well as no circumcision. So things changed over time. So as things change over time, when Jethro comes back as a priest of Midian, it's his responsibility as a priest to offer whatever offering is to each individual god at the respective times. That's what all priests did. If I'm a worshiper of God number 7, whatever God you want to choose, who cares? I go to the priest, "Hey, priest of the number 7 through 45, will you please offer the offerings for the number 7, because that's why I'm worshiping today." That would be Jethro's job. Okay, 7, here's our rule book. Okay, 7 says this. You do these prescribed things for God number 7. It's pretty simple, pretty basic. I'm obviously oversimplifying it, clearly. But the point is, many gods, many responsibilities, many priests, all have their own tasks. This is what Jethro, and he would have raised his daughters to obey and understand. Here's the question I asked my daughter last night. Put yourself in Zipporah's shoes. You were raised by a dad who was a priest of many gods, well respected at least in what his tasks are, trained and understand what those mean and how to worship all these various gods in their ways. You now have a husband who's Egyptian who is theoretically worshiped a lot of gods because all the Egyptians did too. And now your husband comes and says, "Oh, there's only one God. He wants us to cut our son such and such." You, having raised and been trained one way, you're going to say, "Husband, you're an idiot. You know nothing what you're talking about." Hence Zipporah's anger. "You don't know what you're doing, husband. My father is wiser than you. He is a priest. He knows God. You don't. You're a shepherd. You don't know anything. You're Egyptian. You're even below that." So Zipporah's upsetness with Moses is understandable. She's been trained otherwise when she was out throughout her whole life. So then, go ahead.
But she recognized when something was going wrong, and
She recognized.
But she immediately knew she better circumcise him or he's going to die.
Well, she blamed her husband for it.
Well, yeah.
For the circumcision.
She knew something was off.
So she's learned something a little bit in that. Now you tell Zipporah the story. Here's the story of what your husband just did in Egypt. And your father saying, daughter, we were wrong. We were so wrong. We need to go after your husband. We need to address this and fix how wrong we actually are. Put yourself in Zipporah's shoes. You've been trained that your husband was an idiot. Didn't know what he's talking about. And now your father, who's a priest, knows everything, says, oops. We need to go and bow ourselves down and understand what this God actually is. Now you have to change Zipporah's whole mental state of being. That's not easy to do. How many of us change our mental state? Sometimes often, not very often. I don't change mine. I think one way, that's how I act. But she has to. And of course, now we know, see with Jethro's example in chapter 18, he did too. He changed his understanding of what God is. Now, does that mean he's no longer a priest of Midian? Not necessarily. He didn't say there are no other gods. He said your God is greater than the other gods. So his understanding may be still limited. We don't know. It doesn't explain any more details beyond what his theology is. But we understand that he is now recognizing we were so wrong, Zipporah and all my other daughters. There's more to this than we understood before. Hence, he's now coming to Moses, the mountain of God, where God's at, and explaining all these details and learning from Moses what actually happened. So Jethro is changing his polytheism to a little bit closer to a monotheistic belief. A little bit. I won't say a lot. Yes, Deanne.
Because I know that with other cultures that when something happens, they say, oh, it's of God. But Moses actually told them what he was going to do. He told them what was coming. So that made a big difference. It wasn't just a weird weather thing or that they could claim was the gods or a sun being blocked and they would say, oh, that was a God thing.
Right.
Moses actually called it out.
Yeah, he notified them ahead of time.
And it happened. And their priests may have been able to do some of the stuff, but they couldn't make it go away.
Right.
Okay. So there's a big difference in Moses.
And that's how they learned. They learned by observation. They saw great miracles they couldn't duplicate. They couldn't do the same thing. Well, and Messiah points out, a wicked adulterous generation seeks miracles as signs. So what would that say about the Egyptians and even Jethro's history and his life? A wicked adulterous nation. How do we know they're wicked adulterous? How many gods do they believe in? A whole bunch. Answer is solved. That's the answer. Problem solved. That's what it is. So we learn, though Midian themselves, the people didn't change, Jethro started, I won't say he finished his changing belief, but he started to change from this story onward. He started to learn there's more to what I didn't know that I want to learn more about. Yes, your father.
So did Moshe not reveal his actual identity to Zipporah until...
I don't know. It doesn't say. I would guess he probably did because he had stated when he told his father he had to go back and take care of his family. He had to have explained to Jethro at the time who his family was in Egypt because he's Midianite. Jethro's Midianite, but he's not unaware of how Egyptian society works. He would have to go down there periodically for business or whatever the case may be. So he's not unaware of it. He would have known there's a large group of slaves and they obviously operate things. And Moses points out that to bring the people out, he tells Jethro this information. So Jethro had to have found out. Don't know when, whether right at that moment in time with the burning bush or whether it was sometime years earlier, we don't know. But somehow Jethro identified he wasn't truly Egyptian. I say that because in other stories, not including our Bibles, in other cultures, just at the time, no one really liked Egyptians. They were not well thought of. Well, yeah, they were like bullies. They were disgusting, mean people. Other cultures didn't like them. So there's probably a good reason why Jethro would have said, I would have, if I was him, are you really Egyptian? Are you really this kind of person who is a dominant, overbearing, the wish to bully everybody else around to obey and subserve you? I would guess Moses probably told him, not really. Just a guess. There's no actual proof behind it. But many of the cultures hated Egypt at the time, too. So it's a good chance they would have had a conversation at least once in the 40 years he was hanging out there. That they would have talked about it.
Met her in the wilderness, right?
Right. In wilderness of Midian. They had to have met. Okay, let's move on to this topic. Let's move on to the next topic. This is more important than what this is. He does watch. Now, Jethro shows up at what time? He shows up while there's the mountain of God. I'm going to erase some of this stuff.
Did he show up when God was coming on an astronaut ladder?
It doesn't describe that. When he's describing when Jethro is observing Moses, what does he observe about Moses? He's busy. Exactly, overstating himself. And Jethro, this is somebody had asked about the wisdom, I think you did, the wisdom Jethro had. He saw Moses was working and continuously trying to judge the various people. You got however many thousands of cases, and there was a long, long, long line, I'm sure, of disputes waiting for their turn day in, day out to slowly get through the line. So Jethro is observing about Moses, and where is Moses? Moses is at the mountain of God when Jethro meets him. He's already there, right? This is chapter 18 still. We haven't moved on to 19 yet. Still chapter 18. It says, let's see, heard anything about where is it? Oh, there it is, verse 5, chapter 18. Jethro's father-in-law came to Moses with his sons and wife to the wilderness where he was encamped by the mountain of God. So, Jethro shows up when Moses is there. I'm going to draw a picture. Mountain of God, okay? Pretend. Mountain of God, all right? Moses has a little tent, hanging out next to the mountain. Moses in the tent, all right? There's everybody else's, you know, little tents. That's all around. Little stick figures of all different little different people waiting for their turn. So, it's simple. Jethro shows up at this time. Jethro shows up. This time doesn't happen yet in chapter 18. Because in chapter 19 it discusses they arrive there at the mountain of God. So they haven't arrived there yet to chapter 19, but Jethro's he's already there in chapter 18. That tells us the events that surrounded chapter 19 and 20 occur after they arrive, but before Jethro shows up. So Jethro did not necessarily see the big cloud hanging out here with fire on it. He didn't necessarily see that. He may have, but it doesn't require him seeing it. He sees Moses hanging out here judging the people with his little gavel, so to speak. So that's what he's observing. Now your question, wisdom. How did Jethro know how to properly conduct business in a large setting?
He says a lot of different gods and a lot of different people around.
Exactly. So Jethro's line of work, let's pretend here's make a fake altar. We'll put a little, you know, animal on it. Yeah. His little head and ears. Okay. There's an animal on altar. He's going to sacrifice the animal on altar. Jethro is a priest. If you have run an altar or a business, priest or business in a community, how many people do you see on a daily basis? Probably quite a few. The bigger your community, the more people you see, right? So what do? You hire more workers. So you have, you know, yeah, you delegate. There's one priest, I'll give him a little stick figure, and you have, you know, dozens of people wait in line for their various gods of that week. It might change from day to day or from people, who knows. Well, you only have one guy. How many animals can burn an altar at a time? Well, one, maybe two or three. Well, that's only going to cover these two or three people. What about everybody else? Build another altar. Delegate new people. Hire more guys. So Jethro isn't an idiot. He knows how to manage people and knows how this process works because he experiences it on a regular basis, as his business would command him to do. So he's applying this information of, hey, let's build a second altar. Not really, but the point is, let's put more people and judge the people accordingly. Distribute out the workload. Make this simpler. It's not because he's going to burn you out. We ask ourselves, okay, these are very practical things. Why are they even in the Torah? Who really cares? Why are they even in the Torah? Who really cares? Why is this information in the Torah? Who really cares? It just goes away. Does he want to tell us what organization could be? There's a bigger reason, though. Yes, Jeff.
Could it have something to do with about people that were allowed to go up the mountain versus those who weren't?
In an indirect way, yes.
Because of the organization, everybody yes. reports to someone above them. And if you're going to be a nation of priests, you have to report to someone above you.
Always. It's a reporting process. That is the consequence of what this situation creates. It creates individual representatives. this guy and this guy. They even represent the people whom they're judging, this group and this group. And then people, guys, oh, I got four cases this week. Oh, what's your case? Oh, well, I'll describe your cases. Oh, okay, let's discuss this, then we'll bring them to God, or whatever it can be. You get representation that way. There's something else that occurs. If you observe very closely, now I'm not going to sit there, you have to read all this, it's very tedious. But in the book of Matthew, Messiah is doing the same thing. Messiah is doing the exact same thing. Delegating. Delegating. It starts out early in, now this is early in Moses' history, Moses is doing this, early in the sort of the Exodus, as far as he's at the mountain of God, he's judging the people. It's relatively early. They are not, they haven't been there for 40 years. This is the first year out, the first couple months out. The first couple months out. This whole process is replayed in the story of Matthew, in the Messiah's lifetime, the story of Matthew. Let's see, we're going to jump through a whole bunch of parts. Okay, it's not fair to read all of it, but Matthew chapter 4, you judge Matthew chapter 4, this is early on in Messiah's, you know, spiel, what he's doing. That's chapter 4, and start of verse 23. Now, Jethro had instructed Moses, find men that were honorable men, that were not prone to money gathering or desire for bribery and things of that nature, that could be in charge of these various groups. Hence, what does Messiah then do? Matthew 4, verse 23. Then Messiah went out to all of Galilee, teaching the synagogues, preaching the gospel of the kingdom, and healing all kinds of sick and all kinds of disease among the people. His fame went throughout all of Syria. They brought to him all sick people who were afflicted with various diseases and torments, and those who were demon-possessed, epileptics, paralytics, and he healed them. Great multitudes followed him from Galilee, from Decapolis, to Jerusalem, Judea, and beyond the Jordan. How many people is that? A lot of people. How many people with Moses? A lot of people. He, of course, teaches them, I'll go through all of chapter 5. He teaches the basics of what's going through here. The blessed, various categories of being blessed, bless the poor, the meek, the blah, blah, blah. It goes through, of course, the various attitudes, how to be the honorable people of the earth. He's displaying in Matthew 5 and 6 the different instructions on how to view life, how to honor one another, how to live a life with one another. Don't murder, don't commit adultery. He discusses about fulfilling laws and oaths and how these. He's explaining through Matthew 5 and 6, for that matter, and even 7, the details of how God, the kingdom of God, works. The people. He's informing them of God's information. How many people is he dealing with? Probably thousands of them. Thousands of people are traveling through here. He continues on his sequence, but then what does he end up doing? Who are they? The apostles, the disciples. Yeah, the people who start. He starts, and what does he send them out to go do? Bingo. What's he doing? He's taking and saying, I have this information from God. I can teach this small group of people, the disciples or those who become apostles later. And what does he send those apostles out to do? Well, Matthew points out, it says that after he's doing various things, the disciples send out and they go out in his name and do the same stuff. Right. So he's delegating information, just like Jethro told to Moses. You can't do this alone. You must delegate it out. What did Messiah do? He couldn't do it alone. He had to delegate it out. And Moses was nothing. Moses is an 80-some-odd-year-old man. He's going to be there forever. Other people had to understand how this process works. So I'm not going to go through all of Matthew chapter 9. It goes through all the various sequence of how the disciples do the same processes. And they go through the same thing and point out, hey, we did it in your name, and this is what happened. Chapter 10 of Matthew, it ends, or the first part of it points out, I'm jumping through to chapter 10 of Matthew. It says, then when he had called the 12 disciples to him, he gave them power over unclean spirits to cast them out, to heal all kinds of sickness, diseases. And now the names of the 12 apostles were these. He rattles them all off. Jump down to verse 5. The 12 of Jesus sent out and commanded them, saying, do not go in the way of the Gentiles, or in the city of Samaritans, go rather than the most lost sheep of Israel. As you go, preach, saying, the kingdom of heaven is at hand. I'm going to go through all of it. But the point is, he's telling them, hey, all of you, my 12 disciples, that I've been teaching, and I've taught you all these various concepts of God. Now you can do what I was doing. So Jethro's wisdom was applied to Moses, and what then is it applied to? Messiah himself and his disciples. They do the same process, same thing. Go out and do the same thing I'm doing, judge and instruct them of the kingdom of God. What was Messiah's primary message? The kingdom of God. It wasn't, you know, forgive your sins. That's part of it. It wasn't it. It wasn't something. It was, what is the kingdom of God about? That was, he said over and over again. He even said, this is the reason, not one of the reasons, rather, this is the reason God sent me, was to teach you about the kingdom of God. That was the reason. Yes, Daniel.
Didn't Messiah say, I only do the things that I've seen my Father doing?
Right, exactly.
So he's just mirroring what's already in the kingdom.
Exactly. And so when Moses winds up doing this, and God says, yeah, do it. God actually, a couple chapters later, says, yes, you should do this, Moses, make sure this works, and delegate this process out. And God takes some of his spirit and distributes it amongst the various elders and make them all prophesy later on. We read about that in a few chapters later. How God's doing it, God is reiterating the same process that Jethro explains to Moses. Take this and spread it out that everybody can all prophesy and understand. We all spread it out and share it. Make sense so far? All right. Hope I haven't lost you yet. But now it talks about the actual Ten Commandments themselves and a little bit about the third day, which was asked earlier regarding the question of the third day. So the second part for the Ten Commandments leading up to it, God tells Moses, tell the people to wash themselves, to clean themselves for the third day. So they clean themselves for 2 days. And on the third day is when God was going to present his conversation out loud so they all could hear the Ten Commandments with their own ears. They can't say so-and-so mistranslated. No, they all heard the same words. It all says the same thing. All thousands of people listening, they all heard the same words. So he says, clean yourselves for 3 days, for 2 days actually, but on the third day. So the third day, when was that? Now, we have no clue. We know when it isn't, which is 360 days of the year, but the 4 or 5 day window, no one's really sure when it actually fits in there. That's tradition. That's tradition, says Pentecost. It doesn't specify it's Pentecost. So on the third day, tradition, Jewish tradition and Christianity adopted the same for other reasons, but they still adopted it, was that the third day corresponded to Shavuot. One more U. That's a V. Shavuot, which is, we go to the Pentecost, or the name for it, it lands in modern day calendar, it lands the 6th of Sivan, but in the Hebrew calendar, it would land the 5th, 6th, or 7th. It would vary because they had different months of the year, how it would cycle, whether they're 30 days, 29 days, that kind of thing, we have a month. So it lands, Sivan would be the third month. So third month is when it lands. It's usually relatively early on in the third month. Now, that we get this information from the first verse of chapter 19. It says, in the third month of the Exodus. We know what... back in Exodus 19. Because we're going 19-20 to discuss the Ten Commandments. In the third month, so we know what month it is, that they had arrived the wilderness, and of course they journeyed there and such and such. I won't go through all the various places they journeyed. Many people have gone through the different cities and towns and mapped them all out to know within a week or so of what day this actually event occurs in on the Hebrew calendar. So we know it is around or near Shavuot, also called Pentecost. How many of you heard the term Pentecostal? Yeah. Where did they get that name from? 50, from that. Pentecost means 50. The counting Omer of the counting the days of the Omer for after Passover. The Pentecostal, which of course is where we get the Christian Pentecost. Sorry, we have the pre-Christian name Pentecostal, which is a philosophy in how you worship God. Their philosophy is the Spirit of God moves you, whatever that movement means. I'm not going to discuss. And you are worshiping God in that spirit movement. Whatever that means, I'm not going to discuss. That's the term Pentecostal. Many of us have heard of, or even maybe have attended, Pentecostal churches at some time in our existence.
Yeah,
maybe they have. And I won't discuss whether they're right or wrong. It doesn't matter. The point is that we get the term from. So, but if we look at their philosophy of how the Spirit moves you in their understanding of praising and worshiping of God or studying of Him, apply that to the Ten Commandments because they correspond to the same event, theoretically. The same event of God giving the Ten Commandments, the same event when the Spirit of God comes down upon all the men during the Book of Acts. Yes, the Spirit came upon the 70 elders too, also recorded here in the Exodus. So we have this story, this imagery in our head that has this Pentecost, the Shavuot, the Ten Commandments, or Ten Words, I'll do abbreviate, because I don't want to write it all out. Ten Commandments are associated to, connected to, equal to, part of the Spirit of God, which is distributed amongst people and, of course, the elders as well. So these commandments and the Spirit of God are symbolically one and the same, or interchangeable to each other. That's a good understanding. So if we're going to say, well, we're going to follow the Spirit of God, what does that mean? You're following the Ten Commandments. Yeah, which by the Spirit comes. The Spirit is truth. If we say we're going to follow the Ten Commandments, that means you're following the Spirit of God. Because they're one, they're interchangeable. So if somebody says, well, the Spirit moves me, that's great. Where did He move you to? Because the Ten Commandments tells you where you're going. That tells you the path the Spirit's supposed to move you to. Because it's God's Spirit, and He only gave us His laws. This is what His Spirit says. This is how you live His laws. The law to live by. Laws. All right? So in the Ten Commandments, you're studying the Spirit of God. If you study the Spirit of God, you're studying the Ten Commandments. They're one and the same, interchangeable. All right? Any questions so far? So as we're reading the Ten Commandments, we'll read through them. We already read through them. We'll discuss a little bit. This is, imagine, the Spirit of God is doing this or saying these words to all of us to obey and follow. His first commandment, excuse me. What's His first commandment? Chapter 20. No, first. Not fourth. First commandment. Yeah. Yeah, I know. They do break it up. I break it up in my... You're right. I should have been more careful when I say that, because that's not fair. Different religions take the commandments. They break up the first two or so in different delineating lines, which is unfair in how they did it, but that's just how they did it. They disagree with each other. But the first primary commandment, I would argue, was verse 1 itself. Go ahead.
That we're not to have any other gods before Him.
First of all, He says, I am the Lord your God. He's identifying Himself, who was taking you out of the land of Egypt, the house of slavery. Well, yeah. Who or what is God? Right. That's what is commandment number one. Identify what is the one and only God that exists. I am it. That is me. There is none other. If I think there is more than 1, 2, 3, 10, 20, they all have their own rules then. I'll obey this one this week, that one next week, different plans. He's saying, hey, there's only one. Don't worry about all the others you think exist. They don't. They don't matter. Sure. Yes, I am who I am. Yes. I am the only one, and the only one who exists is just me. I'm alone here. It's just me, God. Okay? He's identifying himself. That's commander one. Identify who God is. And what does he say he is? He's the one who took you out of the land of Egypt, out of the house of slavery. Why didn't he say, I'm the one who created all things?
Because everybody knows he's took him.
Right. They know. They saw it. Wow, look at all these miracles. Look at the water and all the... They can physically say, I saw it myself. I can identify which God this is. I'm not an abstract, well, thousands of years ago, he created the this and the that and the forest. Yeah, I'm looking at, okay, whatever. I can see the bloody water that I wasn't supposed to drink, and I can see the big tolls of water that's on the side, and all the Egyptians, I can see that. I recognize it. I know what it is. All right? Yes, everyone knows that. So, Number one, who is God? Identify him. He says, I know who brought you out. That's who I am. So everyone knows exactly who's talking. No questions, no misunderstandings. But he continues on into the second commandment. Not recognize gods of others in my presence. Do not make yourself a carved image or any likeness that is in the heavens above, the earth below, or the water beneath the earth. Do not prostrate yourself to them, nor worship them, for I am the Lord your God, a jealous God, if it is the sin of the fathers upon the children of the third and fourth generations, to my enemies, but those who show kindness to thousands of those who love and observe my commandments. This is all part of these explanations, understandings. We're going into these instructions God gave. So when it comes to carved images, what does that mean? What's an idol? Something that you elevate up higher than it belongs to be. This pen, marker, I could elevate this at how great the marker is. Look how the things it can do. It can write on this board. Wow, that's an impressive marker. Did the marker do that? Not really. It was a tool. Who did it? I did. I wrote the words down. Now, the marker should bow to me because I can write and it can't. Go ahead. I'm greater than it. So when we go to the prophets say, hey, you make idols with eyes and ears and mouths and such. They can't see, they can't speak, they can't eat, they can't hear. But you can. They should be bowing to you. You're obviously greater than they are. But you made them. So if you made them, you're greater than it. Because something that you make is not greater than the one who made it. You can't work that way. So if you made something that looks like or acts like or should be greater than you, you made it. It can't be. We have lots of forms of idols, not just physical objects. Anything you elevate up greater than yourself, greater than a human being, that does not belong to be elevated. I mean, God's elevated greater, angels are even elevated greater, but they're not the same as a human being. We elevate a lot of things greater, though. How many have elevated governments greater? A lot of us do. If we don't, guess what? We go in prison. But what is a government? Is it actually greater? No, it's not. It's man-made. The government can't see. It can't breathe. It can't eat. It can't hear. Humans can. But it can't. So idols can have physical things, or an abstract idea can be an idol. Either one of them can be idols. If you raise something up greater than what it really is, you've treated it, you are honoring it where it doesn't belong, as if it's a god. Now, you may not bow down to it. You may not. You may not. What you do, it doesn't make a difference. What is you elevate something up? So when you're dealing with graven images, it's not just the physical object, what it looks like. It's how we treat something as well. You can still treat something like it as a god, even though it isn't. Well, $1,000 of Christmas trees example, yes. I won't go into too much detail about that, but yes, there's a lot. Prime example, any Christmas tree, a lot of things you can elevate up higher than what it really is. It's a tree. It goes outside. If it's not growing, chop it up and use a firewood, because it's worth something then. Otherwise, it's just a piece of junk. So there's a lot of things that have issues there. So craven images, don't elevate something up where it doesn't belong. Make sense? Okay, let's continue on. Where was I? I just lost. Oh, wrong page. Oh, there it is. Okay, so third and fourth generation. So what does that mean? Now, we discuss, well, God explains at the place of prophets that he does not, even in the Torah itself, it says he does not hold the child guilty the dad's crimes, dad's sins. Every man, woman stands on their own. Yeah. He repeats himself also in the Torah. I've forgotten where it is. When we run across it, which we will eventually, I'll remember it again. You cannot charge a child the crime of the parent. So why would God say, if it is the iniquity of the father for the third and fourth generation, then it seems strange? Yes, Larry.
We forget to teach our children, and they don't learn. Then they don't teach their children, and we get a culture like we have here.
Yes.
Outside of this room and other places of worship where we recognize Messiah, the rest of the people, they don't even know.
Right.
I drive them all the time when I'm doing my Uber driving, and they don't even know who Messiah is and what the difference from one day to another and what God has relationship in their life.
So if their grandparents or parents, yeah, if they didn't go and with diligently loving God or showing those who love him to teach their children, because what did God tell Abraham? I'm choosing you because you will teach your children. That was it. I'm choosing you because you're going to teach the following generations. This is a reason. You follow me, you believe me, and you will teach your children to follow as well. Hence, Abraham, I'm choosing you. Well, if I go some descendant generations later who says, I have no use for that, I'm doing my own thing now, God, go away. Well, now this individual, God say, well, but you're not teaching your children. Esau's example. You're not teaching, you're not continuing on. Even Midian, we talked earlier. You're not teaching, you're not continuing on the instructions God said to Abraham. This is the reason you were chosen, because you will teach your children and they will follow you as well. You're breaking this tradition. You're breaking this instruction to teach your children about me. What does that do? It does reduce the reputation of the father. That's a good example. It does. It diminishes him in many ways. What does that do to the subsequent generation? If I choose today, I will not teach my children God ever again, as long as I live. If I make the decision, this is how it's going to be. What's going to happen to them? They'll know nothing about him. Yeah, I don't know you. You practice lawlessness. You know nothing about me. I don't know you. What about their children? Well, these children were raised in what I instructed. There's no God. They teach their kids the same philosophy. That there's nothing there. And as long as I'm alive, I'm going to reinforce it. Now, eventually I will die. Tomorrow or 100 years, I don't care. Eventually it'll happen. But then if my children propagate my instruction and continue on with it, it affects not just them, to them, their children, and their grandchildren. That's three generations. As long as they're alive. Sometimes, if they're really old, they might get a fourth generation in there. But eventually, when one passes, another one shows up. One passes, another one shows up. It's 3 to 4 generations it affects. So if I hate God, then I can affect 3 and 4 generations beyond me. It is terrible. What breaks that tradition? When one says, hey, no, I won't. Then the history of it vanishes, now we restart. Some child says, my dad, my grandpa, they're idiots. There is a God. He's smarter than them. Shut off this tradition of failing, and God's going to call the person back. Now it restarts. You break the chain. It happens. Many of us have gone through this at some point in our lives, whether it be a chain about God, whether it be a chain about abuse, about hatred. It makes a difference. Any chain. What was that? Soul ties? Or that term? Oh, attached. Right. Yes, you can break that up. From family history, even family curses. Amen. I know people argue about what those mean. But you can propagate those curses, and you can sever them too. The severing is what God's saying. Hey, when you deviate from me, sever that. Restart. And mercy to thousands of those who love me. There's a big difference between 3 generations and 4 generations versus thousands. So we do this. We make this connection, saying there actually is a God. He actually does exist. He does matter. We can break this chain that our child or our grandparent or great grandparent may have started, or even beyond that makes a difference. Somewhere started, you can sever the chain, restart it, and now you can continue on in God's way. So hence the separation. How he doesn't curse the child and grandchild and great grandchild directly. If they are affected by the generation that chose to reject God. And that affecting will continue on until somebody in that line says, I quit. I'm going to stop this and move forward to what is right. Make sense? Okay. Let's continue on. Oh. Yeah, it's a separate topic. It's not discussed in the Torah. We'll discuss this a little. Well, it is a little bit, but it's indirectly discussed. We'll discuss it later. Let's see here. Verse 7. You shall not take the name of the Lord your God in vain. You will not absolve anyone who takes his name in vain. What does that mean, in vain? That's verse 7 of chapter 20. My verse 7. I think it's just the same verse, I think. What's vain mean? What was that? Improperly. That's a good way. What does that mean? Empty. Empty is a good way of putting it, because vanity is empty. Nauticus. Disrespect. That's a good example, too. When we're... What was that?
Triviality.
Making it trivial, unimportant, insignificant. No, insignificant. When you're dealing with the commandments, the Ten Commandments in particular, recall that these are categories of law. So, for example, I may say this in vain. That's just one of these categories of in vain. Well, to know what that means, like, I could say the same thing. It's like, well, this is like business law. For example, how big is business law? Enormous. Okay? So the Ten Commandments are categories of law. When we say, well, God just had to build the Ten Commandments, that's not just 10. That's a roughly 600 or so commandments associated with it. Not quite that, less than that, of those 10. Because those 10 are categories. If I say, I only obey the Ten Commandments of God, that's great. Well, that means you obey the entire book of Deuteronomy, most of Leviticus, and most of Exodus. You're obeying all of the laws. Because those are sub-examples of these 10 commandments. So all of these are broken up that way. The entire book of Deuteronomy is written apart this way. The entire book is. So all the laws written there are broken up into their sections corresponding to the Ten Commandments. So if you want to know what something is, you just read it up. What is it? In this case, we're dealing with vain. I just lost my notes. It is vain. In this particular one is discussed and examples are taught to us in Numbers chapter 30. What vain actually means. What does vain? What does in vain mean? Let's go to Numbers 30 and we'll read. What does in vain mean? Numbers chapter 30 discusses what does in vain mean. You're so vain. Numbers chapter 30 discusses what is taking God's name in vain and making it of no effect, unimportant, or unvaluable. Numbers chapter 30, then Moses spoke to the heads of the tribes concerning the children of Israel, saying, this is the thing which the Lord has commanded. If a man vows a vow to the Lord or swears an oath to bind himself by some agreement, he should not break his word. He should do according to all that proceeds out of his mouth. Or if a woman vows a vow to the Lord and binds herself by some agreement while in her father's house in her youth, and her father hears her vow and the agreement of which she has bound herself, and her father holds his peace, then all her vows shall stand, every agreement which she has bound herself shall stand. If her father, of course, overrules her on that day that he hears, then none of her vows nor her agreements by which she has bound herself shall stand. The Lord will forgive her because her father overruled her. If indeed she takes a husband, while he bound by her vows or by a rash utterance from her lips of which she has bound herself, her husband hears it and makes no response to her that day that he hears it, then her vows shall stand, her agreement shall be by which she has bound herself shall stand. If her husband overrules her on that day and he hears it, he shall... Get the point. What are these vows? Yeah. If you make your vow worthless, you've now taken the Lord's name in vain. The entire book discusses different vows and sequence of how to undo a vow. So these are bound, as the introduction says, this is someone who vows themselves by the swearing by the Lord's name or swearing oath to bind himself by the Lord's name. So you're taking God's name and you are making a vow, I will do this in so-and-so's name. Now, this is important. We discussed earlier the idea of agency. What does agency mean again? Someone who's representing God can speak as if they are God while they're speaking, because they are representing Him. That person who is authorized by God to do so can make a vow in God's name, meaning God is going to do XYZ, whatever it is. Like Moses does, like Messiah did. They can speak in God's name because they have the authority to do so. If somebody who is not authorized comes over here and says, by the name of God, XYZ thing, whatever it is, and it isn't true, what did that person just do? They're a false prophet, to God's name in vain. They tried to speak on God's behalf without his authority. They tried to elevate themselves up that mountain, so to speak, as if they were God, or as if they were Moses speaking. You have elevated yourself up beyond it. So you, if you are going to choose to take God's name in vain or take God's vow without his authority, you're trying to take his position as if you are speaking for God's behalf. That's a problem. No one's allowed to do that. God's flexible, not anybody. So taking his name in vain, vows, is where he has the primary cause of doing it. It's a very critical thing. Yes?
Is that the same as somebody saying, God told me this and this and this and this about you, and
yep,
this is going to happen?
Yes.
And I'm just like, oh gosh, not again. I get that a lot of people speaking for God when I believe we should just be listening to the scripture.
That's correct. Because imagine what happens if that event is described didn't come about the way they described it.
Maybe.
They just defaced God's name.
I've seen it come to fruition, but I still don't
believe it. Even it doesn't work, you don't take God's name in vain. You don't make it where it doesn't work out correctly. That's very, very important. And the only way you can do that is if you're a prophet from God who may contact you directly and said, hey, go do this. Or you were selected in the case of Moses and Aaron and Messiah to do certain things. They were explicitly verbally told by God, go do this, and they went and did it. Yes, Don.
So you talk about a prophet of God. Many people today in different denominations say they or somebody else within that denomination are prophets, or they had a word from God. How do you explain that? In other words...
Well, how do I explain how they're using the words? Or whether or not what they're saying comes true or not? Because they're two different questions.
Yes, we'll answer both of them.
Okay. Just because somebody says something doesn't mean anything. I can say the sky is purple. And I can convince you the sky is purple. And that we've been calling it blue, we incorrectly wrote it. It's actually really the color, the name purple is really its proper name. But if you then go to somebody else who has not heard my teaching about the sky being purple, you say, oh, the beautiful purple sky. He looks at you and says, are you crazy? Are you colorblind? It's obviously blue. Just because I say something doesn't mean anything. Even God points out, you'll have false prophets that even some things may even come true. Now, some things are not rocket science to figure out. I'm just being honest. So these are really simple. Like, this is probably what's going to happen, and you can determine that's what's going to happen. It really does. That's not genius work. It's not necessarily a prophet from God. It's just deduction will give you lots of information. But having done all of that, if the person speaks on God's behalf and God didn't do it, what was under that person? Right. You don't take God's authority upon yourself. That's a very dangerous thing to do. Not necessarily for everybody else, but for you in general, you personally. It's a dangerous thing for you to do because that's risky. You've done something that God did not authorize you to do. Now, what if God actually did talk to that person? Okay, then he did. Then that's what's actually happening, and what will happen is actually what's going to occur. That can be true too. It's in the individual who's speaking that knows whether God actually talked them or whether they are asserting their own authority or own agency over God. And I can't speak to whether that's true or not because I don't know the person. Generally speaking, when someone says, I'm a prophet, I spoke to a prophet, whatever, blah, 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 I can cross-check it. Okay, what did he say? I can look at, about that topic? Okay, God, I'll read that up. Say, okay, did it match? The book does it not match. If it doesn't match the book, say, I'm sorry. I'm not going to pay you your $50 for the fee to prophesy about my was once Cleopatra in a former life. It doesn't mean anything to me. I'm not going to pay your fee because the Bible arguments demonstrate what you're saying is incorrect. On the other hand, if it says completely matches the Bible, that could be. But if they say that it completely matches perfectly, it's like, what you're saying could be. Not that it is, but it could be. And we'll see and find out. And just because someone prophesies today correctly doesn't mean tomorrow they'll be correct. Yeah, I don't trust people in that way because it's a very, very dangerous thing to be. It's not necessarily wrong. They can be completely correct. But I always cross-check it with what the Bible actually say. And if it doesn't say it or doesn't agree with it, something's very suspicious about the scenario. Does it make sense? Yes. Louise.
Okay, I'm throwing in a dart here.
I'll duck.
Artificial intelligence. Artificial intelligence. IA.
Yeah.
They're training robots to talk in the name of Jesus. They're mimicking Christianity. Robots.
Ah. This is actually pretty simple. Where did Marker go? Well, that marker's dried up. Where'd my black one go? Oh, here it is. Oh, this one. This board. That's actually a simple, Louise. It's not complicated. People make it complicated. It's really simple. What is language? Communication. Communication. If an object makes a noise, it's making a noise. The noise means nothing unless the person hearing it interprets the noise into something that's intelligible or understandable. An object can make the noise that sounds like any word you want to say, because it's just a matter of programming the noise. Make the beeper sound this, make the beeper say that. It's just a sound, it's just a speaker. It's pretty simple. Does the speaker hear that we play music, does it actually know what it's saying? Has no clue what it's saying. The computer here that records the music and plays it, does it know what sound's coming out of it? No, it has no clue what it's saying. It knows nothing about it. It's just ones and zeros. Very simple. So just because something is making sounds, an inanimate object, doesn't mean it agrees or knows what it is saying. So when you're dealing with communication and inanimate objects, in case artificial intelligence, the same idea, it's just regurgitating sounds that humans interpret. What if you spoke German and not English? Then the sounds the robot makes are meaningless to you, because you can't interpret them to mean anything. It's just gibberish. If you spoke any other language, other than the sounds the robot was programmed to make, doesn't mean anything to you. So it's not truly intelligence, per se, because it doesn't know what it's actually doing. We, as humans, interpret it to know what it's doing. It's our interpretation that determines whether something's intelligent or not, not the object itself. So even though it can sound and it can use what we determine as pre-programmed logic, which is not that hard to do, of how to get a new solution to whatever existing problem is, it's just computer work, it's fairly simple. That doesn't mean the computer knows what it's doing. It's just going through the algorithms and the ones and zeros, the transistors, to determine what is the outcome. And the user, in this case the user on my end, will say, yes, you got the correct answer, or no, you didn't. Make sense? Okay. So, hand up. Was you open on? Somebody hit.
Going back to vows.
Vows, yes.
Yeah, and in Matthew, Yeshua, in a lot of translations, it says that don't make a vow at all.
Correct.
In a lot of English translations, but that's not actually correct. It's supposed to say in the Hebrew Matthew, it says don't make any false vows.
False vows, right. Because you are taking God's name. It's a big difference. You don't take God's name and bind yourself by it. It's not wise. It's unwise. That doesn't mean you can't make a vow. How many of you took vows at your weddings? Right? Oh, is that breaking God's law? No, it's not. Why not? Yeah, you're making an agreement together. You're binding yourself. And you usually do it in the form of these witnesses around me, including God, if you had a minister in front of you. You're doing things in the form of in God's eyes. So you're taking those vows, you're still following them. So vows have their place, and they're not place. What happens when you divorce? You broke your vow. Now you have problems. Now you're no longer above the law, you're now below it. You're under it. Because there are rules now applied. How do you deal with those? We'll discuss all of them. Yes.
When they divorce, or I mean,
sharpens character.
Yeah, changes. I mean, how do you make peace with that?
Sharpens character. That's not quite the right phrase, I wouldn't think. I wouldn't use that phrase to describe what happens. Divorce is a very complicated situation. It can change a person, and more often than not, it changes children who are the recipients thereof, and it changes how they view life in general. It affects you. Yeah, the effects will. Oh, it's like the third and fourth generation problem. It will affect for generations to come. There is not a proven truth to this, but the people that I personally know, it seems that if you get a divorce, your children tend to get a divorce too. It propagates on. It doesn't happen to everybody, but that seems to go that route. It sets a precedent. Instead of working through your difficulties, you said, I'm choosing this way out of my difficulties. On the other hand, when you don't divorce, you demonstrate to your child, who's preferably learning from you, how to actually cope with difficulties and work through them. That's a far, far more valuable. The child, when they run across their own problems, how do I deal with them? They can remember back, mom and dad did this. Okay, I should be able to do this too, and work your way through it. If the child says, I have no example of fixing this problem, they're at the whim of whatever hits their fancy, whether it's divorce or what it actually is to complete through. So divorce has a propagating effect. It affects following generations, much like those the whole curse God in third and fourth generation. It affects others and continuously messes it up. Yes?
Scientists have also recently discovered that every four generations, the DNA of people correct itself, which I thought was really interesting.
That I had not heard. I do not know about that. That's interesting. Yes, Larry. It could be. Yeah, it could be. I hadn't heard that before. That's interesting.
I don't. We're still on the same topic, but we're talking about taking the Lord's name in
vows.
Vain.
Yes.
The Messiah talked about that in Matthew 5, and he said, "You've heard it said, don't swear falsely." But I say, don't swear at all. But you're right. They says, let your yes be yes.
Let your no be.
So when we swear on ourselves.
Right.
I will or I will not.
Right.
And he says, you can say both ways.
Right.
We
it's
can
fine.
Say, I won't do that or I will do that.
Right.
But we don't bring, as you said, we don't bring the Father into it because
right.
this is our little thing here
yes.
that we're doing.
Exactly. This is not his instruction to you to do something. You are choosing to do whatever it is. And those people who vowed to not eat or drink until they killed Paul. I highly doubt they stuck with it. I'm just speculating, but I doubt they stuck with it. Let's move on, because there's more important things here. I'm sorry. What was that? Yochanan is his name. It'll come back to you. That's all right. Next one. Remember, Shabbat, seventh day. This is going to verse 8. 6 days you work, seventh day you rest from your work. Is your everybody you plus all the stuff you own? And he cites this case, the sixth day from creation. Remember, he told them originally, "I am your God who brought you out of Egypt," because they recognize it. But this time they're going back. Now the reason for Shabbat is creation. Why does he say creation? What's so important about that? Who was that? He rested himself. That's true. He did. He could have cited a lot of things, a reason for resting, a lot of reasons why he could have done so. He did this creation. Who does the creation affect? What was that? Everybody. Everybody. So I cannot say, well, I'm not Jewish, so I'll rest on my own day. Oops. I'm part of creation. I can't say, well, my parents told me that Mondays were better than any other day of the week, so I choose Mondays. Oops. If I do that, I'm pulling myself out of God's creation. If I'm no longer a created thing, what am I? A nothing. I don't exist anymore. So by citing creation, it includes everything. Now, what did God create in creation? What wasn't created? Him. Everything else created. He's the one who wasn't created then. Everybody else is. And what did he do? He rested too. So creation includes all things. So creation applies to both Gentile and Greek or Jew. It doesn't matter who you are. It applies to everybody. It includes your animals who were created also. It includes all things. That's what creation is. So he remembers it as far as remember the Shabbat day to sanctify it, set it aside, 6 days of work, yada, yada, yada. Let's move on. Oh, by the way, if you're curious, yes, go ahead, Jeff.
I guess it might be a little bit of a sticky wicket, but did he create rebellion? Because that gets at a core complaint.
Yes.
that people say, that they read the words of Paul and interpret that, well, he created the Torah basically as a punishment. So thus, he created the Torah to make the people rebel. So did God create rebellion?
That's a funny drawing. He did create rebellion for totally other reasons. That's a good question, though. It's a great point. What was that? We needed it. We need rebellion. I'll show you examples of why. I use stick figures. Okay. So I have a mom and a dad. Okay? They taught me to do that, whatever it is. If it was wrong in God's eyes, and I propagate it, we discussed this earlier, what happens? Then I come along with my wife, and we propagate the same thing. How do I break from the incorrect cycle? I have to rebel against my teaching. I have to rebel against what my parents taught me to do. Respect them. I'm not trying to injure them. But the point is that I am choosing that, hey, what you taught is wrong. What is true is this. So I have chosen rebellion is a tool to rebel against when somebody else is incorrectly acting, whatever the incorrect act may be. It doesn't matter what it is. Rebellion is a creation, and God does use it because he gave it to us to use. Yes?
I would just like to say that the new covenant is a contract, and the law is the terms of the contract.
That's
and
a fair way to look at it.
I was raised a little bit different than what I believe now. When I began to keep the Sabbath and the commandments of God and the law, my mother said, Roseanne, I raised you better than that. I said, no, Mom, you did not.
No, you
not.
Didn't.
So I rebelled against,
you rebelled against
my,
exactly.
my family to right. keep God's law.
Right. Rebellion is built into us in order to rebel. If we can't rebel, then we're screwed. Because we cannot fix anything. Rebellion is an important tool. They're like, well, what about the devil? He rebelled. That was a bad thing, right? Who was rebelling against? Did God create rebellion in him too? Yeah, because who created him? God. So all of his thoughts, opinions, beliefs, emotions, desires, God built all of them. If it doesn't exist, free, which is, that's how we use a rebellion. We use it, hey, I am choosing that what you're doing is wrong. You don't get to kick that puppy 10 times a day. It's wrong. You should stop doing that. I will not propagate it. As opposed to, like, oh, well, my mommy and daddy always said, kick your dogs 10 times a day. That's how we raise them. You're not rebelling. You will maintain the error of your ways. Make sense? So rebellion is not a tool to be abused. It is a used tool. Yes, Anne.
I keep saying to my Aunt Angie, she keeps resisting, you know, anything that I'm trying to help her do. So she could say to me, well, I'm resisting, and that's my rebellion, and that's all okay, because I'm doing it the right way, not Mom's way. And your kids could say the same. They could say
exactly.
Tomorrow,
yep.
Well, Dad, you said rebellion was okay.
Exactly, and this is how I verify it. This is how I verify it. As I say, hey, if I'm doing something wrong, I have to rebel about what I'm doing that is wrong. If my kids come and say, hey, Dad, the Bible says this, and you taught that, it's my job to say, oops, I was wrong.
Okay, well, if the child can go back to the source and show you, Dad.
That is the source.
Kicking the dog is not the right thing to do. And
right.
Dad, you just kicked the dog.
Right.
That's right.
Exactly.
Yes.
So in the case when you're dealing with Angie, to be fair, her mind is not there, so it doesn't work well. But the idea of the rebellion, if my children point out, and even Isaac did earlier this last week, he pointed out a mistake that my wife and I were making about a fish we have and didn't realize that. He said, hey, that isn't right. And we had to realize, oh, you're right. That isn't right. If he can't come to me and say, hey, stop what you're doing something wrong, I won't be able to fix what I'm doing. So I need somebody who can rebel against me saying, stop, Dad, this isn't the right thing to do. Take care of the fish first. I realize, oh, you're right. See, that rebellion is a useful tool. If he can't come to me and say, stop, We got a problem. I mean, I will always be the dictator that says we do this or that, and I'll never actually improve. Make sense? Well, he wasn't, you know, cursing me at it. He was pointing out, we should really do this. Oh, okay. It'd be respectful. We're not rebellion out of disrespect. Rebellion respectfully, as Larry pointed out. Respectful. Deanne.
Just quickly, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego had to rebel because they were going against what God commands.
Exactly. So rebellion is a useful tool. So yes, God created rebellion. And we use it properly, not improperly. Make sense? Okay. We're going to move forward. I'm out of time, so I'm going to skim the last of them. I apologize, but...
Are you rebelling against
me? Yeah, I know. I'm rebelling against you now. Look at me. I'm a terrible person. Honor your parents. This basic principle, honor your brothers, you'll live long in the land that you will come to. This very simple, obviously. If you cannot honor the one you can see, how are you going to honor the one you can't? Your parents are right in front of you. They tell you, go do this. If you can't honor that and obey and follow the instruction, how are you going to do with who's not even speaking to you, but does indirectly through a book, how are you going to honor that? It's pretty simple. Yeah, if you apply the honor from a parent's side, we learn it as children to then apply it to the God relationship we have as our father. So the honor of your parents is a training tool you must do and continue to do so. Again, if you can't do it with what you can see, you're never going to do it with what you can't. Pretty basic. I won't go through all the details of that, but that includes a lot of things. But Adam and Eve are failures at that point when they had dishonored God in that way. And they could see him too, which is too bad, huh? Anyway, let's move on. If you want to study that with the honor of your parents, Leviticus chapter 19 and 20 discusses a lot of details about what honor means, Leviticus 19 and 20. And the commandments for, you shall not murder, there's lots of categories of murder, a lot of laws explain the different versions, what is murder, what is not murder. Those are recorded mostly in Deuteronomy chapter 19, 20, and 21. These are all the standards which God said, this is what murder is, and this is what murder isn't. So we categorize those. We say, I obey the commandment, do not murder. And say, oh, really? Give me the examples. Well, the examples are written right here. These are the laws I'm going to obey. These are God's instructions. Deuteronomy 19, 20, and 21 discuss murder. And what is and what isn't murder. Which is that could not commit adultery. What is adultery? Well, adultery is a lot of different things we interpret adultery to be. We interpret it as strictly as two people who are married to others consort with one another. We interpret that as adultery. Adultery is far bigger than that. That's one example. There's lots of examples of adultery. Adultery is a use or a twisting of what is proper in what God's eyes in a sexual base. So in this case, most of them are recorded in Deuteronomy 22, but it also includes Leviticus 18 and Exodus 22, 16 through 19. So there's a lot of examples of what adultery is. In adultery, Deuteronomy 22 discusses the different examples of adultery. It also discussed again in Leviticus 18 about different forms of adultery. And Exodus 22, verses 16 to 19, also discussed different forms of adultery. These are all different categories that belong in adultery of what you do and don't do and how you conduct with one another. It's not just the one narrow definition. Right. It's many different categories of relationships of people you're related to, unrelated to. Those are all forms of adultery. Your uncle versus your niece. Uncles and nieces. That's also adultery. It's a twisting of what is proper. So all these different categories are so you can and cannot do. Does that make sense? Yeah, that's part of it too. That's part of adultery. It includes incest.
Adultery.
A lot of it for, yes.
Adultery. False substitute.
False substitute. That's a great way of condensing it down. You're taking a substitution of what you should do and switching it with something that you should not do. You falsely substitute something. That's a good way of wording it. So that's a class of adultery. And when you want to study what is stealing, we think of, oh, well, taking what's not mine. It's bigger than just stealing. The commandment, we've got an eighth commandment for stealing. It includes mistreating somebody else who is in need. That's also a form of stealing. It's a record in Deuteronomy again, the details of it. I include Deuteronomy chapter 23, 24, 25, and 26. Deuteronomy 23, 24, 25, and 26. Those discuss the details of stealing and mistreating other people. It includes stealing wife, stealing property from man, or stealing from God, stealing from the poor, and stealing from future generations. All those categories are grouped into stealing. You can't do any of them. They include... Yeah, governments borrow in the future for a long time. Because reality is, our government's never going to pay it back. They did steal. But all these are grouped into stealing. It's not just a, oh, I took what wasn't mine. How did you treat, who'd you take from, all the details beyond it. It includes all forms of stealing. So studying them and learning about them, these are categories of stealing. It's also recorded again in Exodus 22, the first 15 verses also talk about stealing as well. The ninth commandment, which is a false witness, dealing falsely with somebody else, incorrectly identifying what is true versus not true, that's covered dominantly in Deuteronomy 19. Deuteronomy 19 is for false witnesses from verse 15 through 21. That's Deuteronomy 19, verse 15 to 21. That discusses what is false. False witnesses, what do you do with somebody who incorrectly falsified something? How do they handle the situation? What is this? What is proper? What is improper? And when dealing with coveting, the last commandment, commandment 10, it just deals with what wanting when it does not belong to us. Now, that's a broad grouping. The New Testament does discuss coveting in great detail at different times. I won't discuss all of them. But you got Hebrews 13 discusses the idea of coveting. Hebrews 13. It also is repeated similarly in Ephesians 5, the first five verses. Because someone who covets cannot inherit the kingdom of God. And of course, also in Luke chapter 12, verses 13 to 34, discusses also being content with what you have. Coveting is a critical component of Christianity in general. Being content with what you have is very important. Why? If you are not content with what God gave you, then you're claiming God made a mistake. If I'm not content, if God said, here, Daniel, here's your cookie, I say, God, I should have had 7 cookies. And God looks at me and says, Daniel, I gave you your cookie. Accept the cookie. But God, you should have given me 7. And he says, thank you for the cookie back, Daniel. Go do something else. I'll keep the cookie I gave you. Be content with what you have. If you have something more, it's because God gave it to you. And that is yours to do. If I'm a multi-billionaire and I employ thousands of people, God gave that to me to do. Be content with it. If I'm a poor pauper begging for scraps, that's where I'm at. You have to be content with it. That's not mean you have to stay there. It means you'd be content with it. I mean, accept this is what it is, and I will strive to work for more, whatever it may be. If I want the other 7 or 6 more cookies, I say, God, what do I need to do to get the other 6 cookies? And God may say, ah, Daniel, I will give you another cookie if you do whatever it is. That is going willing to go work for more than what I've got. That is not coveting. That is working for more than what you have. Coveting is, God, I want those other 6 cookies. Give them to me now. That is a demanding of, you made a mistake by giving me just 1. I should have had all 7. It is your mistake, God. Fix your mistake. Here is your opportunity to fix your mistake, God, because I'm pointing out you made a mistake. You don't do that. Coveting is a critical thing. Why we don't want to be that or be that type of person. God says, you will not inherit the kingdom of God, those who covet. So covet's a critical component. I am out of time to discuss the more important details of some of these things. I apologize. But when you come across this concept, this is a problem mostly between Gentile thinking and Jewish thinking. In the New Testament, it talks a lot about the laws of God. Oh, these laws are under the law, over the law, upside the law. What are you going to say? Lots about the law. In Judaism, there are two categories of law. Just two. There's categories of God's law and categories of sinning against God's law. They're all broken up into these two categories. So you think that God's law, the Ten Commandments, for example, are examples of the law. And lots of citations with you, you study those citations I gave you, are examples of God's law. They're all God's laws. Those are all the Ten Commandments are included. I'm going to abbreviate. And all the different subcategories of those commands are including God's law. These are the laws of God. It includes holy days, because lots of things. When we break the laws of God, we jump from this side over to this side, the laws regarding sin, which has sacrifices, repentance, what else is there? There's a lot of, basically, I'll break it down, just basically. That's where the laws of sin are involved. So, I stole a cow from my neighbor. What's my penalty? Well, the sin is you pay the payer back, 20% more. Those are all the laws regarding the laws of sin, which you're under. When you break a law of God, you move from this side to this side. You have to fix it to move back over here. If you're on the laws of God, you're always above the law. Because the law can never penalize you if you've obeyed it. Can a police officer cite you for speeding in a zone when you weren't speeding? You're actually following the speed limit. Well, he could, but shouldn't legally. He's not supposed to. You're following the exact law the way it's written. You haven't broken the law. He shouldn't be right to cite you for breaking the law. It's unjust to do so. And God's more just than a police officer. Theoretically, no offense. We'll discuss that. The idea is that when you are following the law, you're not below the law. When you've broken the law, you are now below the law. The law is now over you. You must correct for the breaking. That's the idea here. So you did the laws of God are the categories of the commandments that you are obeying them. You haven't broken them. Then none of the sin, repentance, commandments, sacrifices are applicable to you. Yes?
Can we say that those are explicit and these are implicit?
Well, these are expounded upon. He does explain them, though. He said when you do sin, you have these different things you must do to fix it. Yeah, exactly. It's a curse. There are two ways of life. You either obey God's instructions or you don't. And the don't category, you are living in this area. You will stay here until you obey these to move back over to here. So if I choose... Yes, it's also part of the Torah because it's spelled out in the Torah. If it wasn't written in the Torah, I wouldn't know what these are. By definition, if I say, Larry, don't stand up. Well, that means I'm telling you also, you could choose to sit down or you could choose to lay down. By saying the word, don't stand up, then it gives you all the other definitions that I didn't say. Kneeling, laying down, sitting down, rolling around. Oh, well, they might be okay. because by the opposite of what I've said is true, by me saying what I said, it, all of the categories then follow suit. So, Apostle Paul points out, I wouldn't know what sin was unless the Torah told me. Well, by telling you what God says, don't commit adultery, what does that mean? Well, now the Torah, by saying don't commit this, I now have the whole list of all the examples of what that is. So by not doing it, I know what it is. That's otherwise, if I didn't know what it was, I couldn't know how not to do it. So the opposite's always defined along with what the instruction is. The law. Slavery to law. Right. The law. Right.
Slavery to law of sin and death.
Correct. That's
but
in this category.
If that is part of the Torah, then it is. We are slaves to the
right.
To the Torah.
Because,
slaves to the Torah.
Right.
And bound under it.
Yes. As long as you've broken it, you're in this category.
As long as you've broken it.
If you haven't broken it, this doesn't apply. You stay here. You're only the laws of God, which are good and righous and holy and just. You're not slaves because you are, according to Galatians, you are an inheritor. You want this because you are a son of God now. This you desire it. So, that's freedom. It's in this category is all freedom. And this category is all bound in death and misery. Here is not. Does it make sense? It's okay. You don't have to be convinced. The point is, this is Jewish thinking. Yeah, this is Jewish thinking. When you're thinking Jewish, think as a Jew as opposed to a Gentile. A Gentile says, well, but the gods of laws, the laws of the Torah, can broken into thousands of subcategories. Lots of groupings, here, and to dissect them. Jesus doesn't do that. It's a group of what does this whole law mean? It's a whole unit thing. Don't break it apart. It's one unit. So we're dealing with the laws of God. He's saying, keep the Sabbath day. I say, okay, that is a law of God. Now he says, what happens if you don't keep the Sabbath day? Well, that, if you don't keep it, you now move over to here. You're now in the law of sin and death, which is the undesirable category. To fix this, there's various prescribed instructions to move you back from here over to here, which you're now above the law again, because you're now just following it. You're not breaking it. Does that make sense? Hopefully it does. But that's the Jewish way of thinking it, because there's only two ways to exist. You obey God's laws, or you don't. It's only two ways of life. And Moses points it out, because he says there's only two ways. Messiah points out there's only two ways. The apostle pointed out there's only two ways. There's only two ways to live. You either follow or you don't follow. There's only two options you have. And the only two ways to live, follow is the one which lives, and the don't follow is one which dies. You don't want to stay or live over here. Messiah's death sacrifice took care of the sin part of that sacrifice. That doesn't mean it took care of anything else over here. You still can't go off and murder people. Say, well, God, he died for my sins, right? I can murder people. No. He didn't pay for that. That's over here of don't murder. You can go back over here if you wish to by rejecting his offering and going off to murder people, which is what you're doing by doing so. So you can still be here, even though you accepted Messiah as your offering. You go off and murder people. Sorry, you still die from it. Because you stayed over here. You made his sacrifice meaningless because you didn't stay and live over here like you belonged. He died to get you over here, so stay here. When you make mistakes, the mistake's one thing. When you're choosing to stay over there, over the sins, that's your mistake. That's your life you're choosing to do. Right. I don't know what the gripe is. Being under the law, under it, means you're in this category. You have to fix something. You have to fix whatever you're in. That's under it. When you're not under it, you're not fixing anything, you're just living it.
Even though you've got grace, and you're sinning against the law,
As long as you're living here and you're choosing to stay under the laws of sin, which is death, then you're staying there. He said, well, I have grace, and I'm sleeping around, and I'm killing people. Grace won't apply anymore. That would be cheap grace. Or, he died so I can do whatever I want now. And Apostle Paul wrote, you can't do that. That's absurd. You live over here like all the apostles did and the Messiah did. They lived over here and said, live like I'm living, guys. This is how you live. That's what the point is going on. That's how these categories are broken apart. Does it make sense? Hopefully it does. Most Levitical priesthood operated in this category. Not that they were sinners, but that was their job. Fix the people from here and bring them back over to here. That's their job. That's what they did. That the whole book of Leviticus discusses this topic. They scare him out of hell, so to speak.
Hold on,
questions. Don, yeah, go ahead.
You were talking about coveting. I noticed that you only used
a few examples. Examples, yes. The coveting examples in the Old Testament are sparse. Let's see here. You know, I didn't write the one down. Dang it. I should have done that. It was discussion of the coveting of... It was Elijah's example to the people with the gods of Baal gods, and the citation of Jezebel and Ahab about the coveting. Ahab wanted the vineyard, and so Jezebel made a scenario and said, "Well, I'll get it for you," and got the vineyard by killing. I forgot the guy's name. God forgive me. Whatever his name is really important. Naboth, thank you. To kill him in order to get... He coveted, he wanted something that wasn't his. He was not content with me. Abe had a ton of stuff. He's king. He had a lot of things. He didn't need anything more, but he wanted something more. He was not content with it. So he made a scenario to make that happen. That was an example of the coveting. Where does coveting lead to? It leads to a whole host of sins. Murder, stealing, lying... Whole host of getting what you want, because that's where it's going to lead your heart, lead your will. So it's in that those examples. Yes, Deanne.
So with grace, the believer is growing and changing and learning. They're under grace until they realize what they're doing is wrong.
You're always under grace as long as God can pay for this one. grace applies. He's giving you favor. Grace means favor. He's allowing you to go from here over to this side. You're always moving over. Now, well, I'm in the process of it. So if I have, let's just say, for example, I've got, I'll use this conveniently, 10 lists of screw-ups. 10 of them. I may have 1,000. But I'm assuming just 10. I say, okay, all these screw-ups, I'm stuck on this side because I screwed up. You know, I lied, I murdered, I slept with 10 people yesterday, and a lot of things. Just dumb stuff, right? Yeah. Okay. Oh, yeah, you're right. Just 10. It's even. I'm in this category. Now, grace can get me out of it. Grace means favor with God. If I say, wait a minute, I don't want to live here. I don't want to be here. I'm going to do something about it. I can move and use God's grace, His favor, move from here over to here. Not like this, not instantaneously. I have to work at it. Tomorrow, I may say, you know what? I've improved a lot. I only have 4 left. But I still participate. You're putting off the old man. It takes time. It's not instantaneous. It's continuous work. And the point is, the goal is to get over here and stay here. I'll give you an example. Let's say all 10 things, each of them are death penalties. Every one of them are death penalties. Now, is it a problem? Do I care if I die from penalty number 4 versus penalty number 6? No, I'm dead from all of them. So it doesn't make a difference. The point is, the goal is to get from over here over to this side, where I don't have that problem. That's the objective. The grace is the solution, or the tool for which I get there. Grace means God's favor. How do I get God's favor? Well, Messiah is the only solution to get there, because otherwise I have to use animal sacrifices to get there. And the apostles point out, those don't really mean anything. Maybe not.
There's things about me that I'm blind to, that I don't see. So I don't see something, okay, let's say, and this is true about me, I used to rattle off and just say the rudest things to people, and it was like no big deal. I didn't realize that I was doing that. I mean, you would think I would realize that, but I didn't until I prayed and said, God, just in case there's something I don't see me doing that's wrong, because it's wrong to mistreat people. It's wrong to talk rude to people. So He started to show me over time, yes, this is something you're not seeing. And then I would ask people, they would be a little afraid to say something to me because I was so aggressive. So eventually I put off that behavior. Okay. But there's other blind spots I have. So my question is, am I under death? Because a lot of the things are a sin unto death. But if I haven't seen what I'm doing until God shows me, and He shows me a little bit at a time, I mean, I couldn't handle if He showed me everything all at once, I'd probably drop dead. But that's my question is, are you under, if your heart is working toward obeying God, obeying His Ten Commandments, that I want to be righteous, I want to make it in His kingdom, and even though I'm blind to things that could be under the law of death and sin, does that make a difference? If my heart is toward growing and being in His kingdom, I mean, He can't possibly show me. He could, but He doesn't do that to me, if that makes sense.
In your example of a citation, every human is there. Every human is there. Same scenario you're in. There isn't a single one of us who isn't. We're all still there. So I have things that God has pointed out to me, Daniel, to go fix them. Some things He has not pointed out to me yet. I'm still working at it. As long as I am alive, I have the ability to continue working on those things. All humans are here under the sin of laws of death. We all are. We choose to work, to believe and follow, to move over from this side to this side. As long as we are alive, this is a continual process. It never ends. When we die, it's done. As long as we're alive, we're always in this loop. The goal is to stay over here. And when we make mistakes, we move back over here. What do? God help me fix the mistake. Guess what? We move back over in this side again. It's a continuous cycle. I only know of the sins that God's revealed to me. I don't know about the ones he has not revealed to me yet. He might tomorrow or next year. I don't know them. But the ones I do know, if I say, God, I really don't want to work on that one. There is no reason for me to move on to the next list. Make sense? Okay. So as long as your list exists, which means as long as you're alive, you'll continuously be in this loop. And now we can say, but we're under grace now, we're saved. Yes, that's the whole point. You can move from here over to here. Before, you couldn't. That's the problem. If you couldn't move, it'd be a problem because you're stuck. With the law of grace, you have the ability to move from one side to the other side. That's the goal. If we ignore and forget what we're doing and continue on in our sins, we're not trying to move anymore. Whenever God says you're done, you're done. Which usually means you're dead. Yes, Jeff.
Well, one good example that we have in Scripture of that is King David and Bathsheba.
That's a good example.
Because, you know, there you've got an example of coveting among other things.
Yeah,
things
yes.
Leading into murder and et cetera, et cetera.
Yep.
But that was one where finally, you know, he was completely blind to it.
Yeah, he just didn't
basically
see.
Basically, it blinded himself over time to what the laws of God were. So
When
the prophet Nathan comes in there and basically tells him the parable of the lamb
of the sheep,
and such, and then finally he gets it that it is about him, and he realizes that he is now under the law of sin and death.
Yep.
So he then becomes under grace.
Yes.
For his life.
Yep.
But
it costs something.
It costs.
Costs a lot.
It costs. And he learned that lesson, and you see the big turnaround in his life is recorded in Psalm 51 of what the turnaround
was. You alone,
was
God,
within.
That I sin against. Yep.
Yes.
Yep. It's a great example. We're always in this category. The goal is to always move forward, getting out. If I go by a year or a couple years go by it, I have not grown. Why did I just waste those years? I didn't do anything useful with it. I didn't move forward. Yes, Anne.
There was a song I learned long ago was, he who's begun a good work in you will be faithful to complete it.
To complete it, yes. Yeah.
That answers the end. Is your blessing is to know that God will be faithful to complete the work.
He's still working with each of us to move forward. We all are in the same category. There's no special person here or anywhere else. We're all under there. Let's see here. I'm going to go into the next section. The rest is not terribly important regarding this idea. But hopefully this makes sense to you if we're dealing with the laws of God, Ten Commandments, and where they fall. The Ten Commandments fall under here, and these commandments of God, which includes, you know, holy days, various other things, are all categorized here. We can read about them. We can also read about when we screw up this side, how we get out of that screw up, which is how where Messiah comes in, the paying for sins, and how that process is supposed to work. So hopefully this makes sense to all of you. Any questions about how this cycle is supposed to work, the examples given to us, the Jewish way of thinking? Hopefully makes sense to you. Jewish, yeah, that's all like that. The other example I have, which is just, remember Isaiah's burning mouth?
Yeah,
when the angels, the seraphim, which means the hot ones, burned his mouth. Yeah, burned his mouth up. Did he know he was saying evil, rotten things? Yes, because he said, God, I have an unclean mouth. I know better, and I haven't tried to fix it. What do I do? And God says, oh, that's okay. I got this covered. Now, mind you, an angel doesn't get burned, but he used tongs to hold on to these coals. It must be really hot to burn Isaiah's mouth. Now, we discussed whether he was burned or all the details of how it all means. The point is, Isaiah recognized a failure in him that he was not addressing until that moment in time. When he realized, uh-oh, I need to address this. Just because you are doing a sin and you know about it, doesn't always mean you're willing to fix it. That's all sin, transgressions, iniquities. We have all these categories of how the severity of sins. The point is, learning to address them and be willing to address them is how you address these and move from this side over to this side. And when he was done burning his mouth, they said, "You're clean. You have a blister, but you're clean. You'll never forget it, but you're clean." The point is, it's a process which Isaiah even knowingly knew he was sinning. Now, his sin, it was sin, what you were describing. Instead of cursing other people, speaking evil, speaking mean of them. That was his complaint. That was his problem. We say, oh, well, he had bad foul language. That's what it is. Foul language is cursing other people. Oh, God blank this, or yeah, all those are the taming of your tongue, which is the hardest one for human beings to tame. He couldn't tame his, and so God had to help him through taming his tongue. Does that make sense? So all these things, every person lives here at some point in time in their, actually most of their lives. They move over here on a hopefully daily basis, or as frequently as possible, to live on this side. Trusting that you actually are over on this side. Makes sense? Any questions or comments? Yes.
I thought Isaiah was saying that he was just unclean or a sinner. I didn't mean, no, it no. meant that he had a bad mouth.
He had a bad mouth. Yes. They said he had a bad mouth and he lived amongst people with bad mouths. That's the people of Israel. Speaking evil of others. Like evil of others. Now, he doesn't describe the language he used. I'm glad he didn't. He doesn't describe who he cursed. I'm glad he didn't. Because we'd probably use it ourselves and say, hey, he did it. But the point is that we would learn that the act itself is the problem for him. But the important thing, he wasn't willing to address it until the situation came to him and God said, you're going to address it now. We have to fix this because I have a job for you. And that's how he was willing to address it. Before that, he wasn't willing to. He knew about it. But he even said so. I know I have a bad mouth. He knew about it. But he wasn't willing to address it. If you're not willing to address it, God's not going to move you on. Fix it first, then we'll move you forward. Does that make sense? Any questions or comments? I took you over time, I apologize. Conclude the prayer. Almighty God, our great Heavenly Father, thank you for the Shabbat day of rest. Thank you for teaching us what is good and right in your eyes. Father, help us to be good servants, to follow as best we can, and guide us along the way. May you be pleased with us. May we be pleasing in your sight, Father. We ask your blessing the rest of our Shabbat and the food that we eat, that we share, the fellowship we have, Father, and our lives we teach with one another. We praise you, Father, in Yeshua's name. Amen.
You've been listening to a discussion at Hallel Fellowship. If you would like to hear more discussions or if you have any questions, visit the website at hallel.info. That's H-A-L-L-E-L.info. Hallel.info.